All right, we're beginning here on the top of Samachon Aleph by the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, "Lo yiftach adam lechatzer shutvim petach keneged petach, v'chalon keneged chalon." Person may not open up within a chatzer shutafim a doorway opposite another doorway, chalon keneged chalon, a window opposite another window. Hayak katan lo yasenu gadol. If he has a small doorway, he shouldn't make it big. Echad lo yasenu shnayim. It's one. He shouldn't make them into two. When it comes to the Reshut HaRabim, you can open up petach keneged petach, a doorway against another doorway, v'chalon keneged chalon, or a window versus another window. Haya katan ose oto gadol. If it was small, you can make it big. V'echad ose oto shnayim. If it was one, you can make it into two. So here you have a Mishnah that lays out, first of all, a difference between chatzer and Reshut HaRabim, which is all the things that are permitted in Reshut HaRabim are not permitted in the Chatzer, or vice versa. The second thing that we have in the Mishnah is that in the Chatzer, there is a requirement to maintain the status quo, plus there is a requirement not to do certain things, which is open up doorways versus doorways, or windows opposite windows. Man wants to know, Menahane Mile, how do you know that that's the case? Amar Rav Yochanan, Amar Kra. Pasuk says, it's very famous, Vaisa Bilam et Einav. Bilam looked up, Vayaret Yisrael shochein lishvatav. He saw Bnei Yisrael tented, split up into their shvatim. Mara'ah. What did he see? Ra'ah she'em pitchei o'aleyem mikuvanim zelezeh. They saw that the doorways of the tents were not aligned. Amar ru'uim halalu shetishra aleyem shechina. Says that these individuals, they are ra'uy that the shechina should descend upon them. So that's what the Bali Tosafot say over here, that they learn that from the pasuk which says, Vatihi alav ruach elukim, that the ruach Hashem descended upon him, meaning that the hashrat hashchina was the result, or was from the fact that Bnei Yisrael were in that manner. They were set up in that manner. So he sees the continuation of the pasuk that resulted in the ruach elukim, resulting from, or being caused by the way that they were structured. The Rashbam, on the other hand, brings what is the continuation of the pasuk, which is, he begins afterwards, of Kichach Amar. That's why Bilam continues, Matovu Ohalecha Yaakov. How beautiful, how wonderful are your tents, Yaakov. She'ein Pitchei Olehem Mikuvanim. That was why he was saying, Matovu Olecha Yaakov, which is a description of what he saw. That's the continuation of the statement here. He looks up, he has the Ruach Elukim, and then he speaks about what he had seen, which was Matovu Olecha Yaakov, Mishkenotecha Yisrael. So some say that that's where it comes from. It's called Mishkenotecha, comes from the Hashkein, that the Shechina rested upon them. So the Pasukim over here indicate the fact that the setup of the tents in the Midbar were in such a manner that it struck a chord with Bilam, or he took note of it, that it was unusual the way that they acted. And therefore, the Shechina rested upon them, or it was Ra'oi that the Shechina rested upon them, because of the way that they conducted themselves. That there was this tzniut that was apparent, as the Rishbam says in the Mishnah, v'tam mishum tzniut. What has to do with tzniut? Meaning that protecting each other's privacy, and that each one should have the ability to do what they need to in their house without having the fear of someone else looking in. The Rabbeinu Gershom, on the other hand, says it's mipnei hezek ri'iyah. That's a problem of what we've been discussing in the Masechta until now, which is hezek ri'iyah. So the question of whether it came mishum tzniut, which is really on the recipient side, which is that they had the ability to hide themselves or be in private, or it's a more problematic side from the person who would open up or would look in, which is that there's hezek ri'iyah from it. Obviously, there are two sides of the same coin, but the Rashbam focuses on the tzniut side and the Rabbeinu Gershom, the hezek ri'iyah side. The Rashbam already asked the question, which is, we just distinguished in the Mishnah between a chatzer and Reshut HaRabim. Isn't Machane Yisrael a Reshut HaRabim? If that's the case, then they had no requirement to not be opposite each other, not open up their tents directly opposite each other. So the Rashbam over here narrows the scope of the Reshut HaRabim in the Midbar, which is that only Machane Levi'ah had the classification of a Reshut HaRabim, whereas the rest of Machane Yisrael did not have a classification as a Reshut HaRabim. Assume that partly has to do with the fact that the Mishkan is found in the middle, and Machane Levi'ah is camped around the Mishkan. Everybody goes towards the Mishkan, so therefore Machane Levi'ah became an area that had people traversing or walking into, that's why it became a public domain. It's based on the Gemara in Shabbat that discusses Rishut Rabim with regards to the Agalot and the Krashim. Now, that could have also been not even all of Machane Leviat. Might have been where they traveled, or the roads that they traveled, or where the Agalot were parked. But the Rishbam limits the area of Rishut Rabim. The Ritva, on the other hand, says that maybe the Gabe Shabbat, it might have been that way. But over here, it would have been classified as Rishut Rabim. Nevertheless, Bnei Yisrael did Lifnim Mishut Adin. That even though it wasn't required of them, they still did it. And that was what was so striking to Bilam. That despite the fact that it wasn't required, or despite the fact that it was a public thoroughfare, they still set themselves up in such a manner as not to face each other, to give each other that extra privacy that they required or wanted. So based on that, the Mishnah says that's the source for the fact that one may not do that. Unfortunately, the modern day Israel does not necessarily follow or abide by these laws, and many of the buildings that are built today in Israel have doorways facing doorways and windows facing windows. As opposed to other things that we see in the Masechta, by which the Chachamim were instituting a certain amount of, call it social contract, in determining what are the protocols or the proper ways to behave. This here has a source in the Torah, and really involves an Isur, and therefore there is a much more stringent issue, which you may not be able to be mochel on, because of the fact that it is something that is incorporated in the Torah, and the Torah demands this type of behavior, and therefore mechila in this instance may not be sufficient. The Gemara continues, Ayah katan lo yaseno gadol. If he has a smaller doorway, you can't make it bigger. Savar Rami Bar Chama Meimar. Rabbi Bar Chama says, he thought, Bar Dalid, if you have a door that is 4 amot wide, lo yishlave bar tamnil. You can't make it into an 8 amot wide door. The kashakal tamia bechatzer. Because then you extend your reach into the chatzer. That goes back to what we saw in the beginning of the Masechta in the first parak, which is that every doorway into the chatzer is granted a space of 4 by 4 amot in front of it. You get an area in front of it of your personal space where you can unload, load your things, keep your items. So in front of every doorway that you have access into the chatzer with, you get 4 by 4 amot. Now, that works if the doorway is anywhere up to the width of 4 amot. If your doorway is greater than 4 amot, then you get the whole width of the doorway plus 4 amot depth into the chatzer. So everybody is afforded a depth of 4 amot. The width of that amount is determined by the width of your doorway. Anything up to 4 amot, the width of a doorway, you get 4 amot. That's whether it's 2, 3, 4, it doesn't matter. You'll get 4 amot by 4 amot. If your doorway is greater or wider than 4 amot, then you'll get whatever that width is plus the depth into 4 amot. So what Rami Bar Chama is suggesting is that the Mishnah's restriction involves only a case where you're going to expand your reach into the chatzer, which is that until now you had 4 amot by 4 amot because you had a doorway that was 4 amot wide. You double the width of your doorway now from 4 amot to 8 amot, you're actually going to get a space of 8 amot wide, 4 amot deep. So you're going to double the space or reach that you have into the chatzer that's considered your personal space in the chatzer. Aval, bar tarte l'shavye bar arba, you probably dropped the hay here because we're talking about amot, but if you have a 2 amot wide door, then it could be made into a 4 amot wide door, because in that case, you're not going to change your reach into the chatzer. A 2 amot door still gets 4 amot wide by 4 amot deep. So too, a 4 amot wide door is going to get you 4 amot by 4 amot. You don't change your position within the chatzer, what your personal space within the chatzer. So there's Shapir Dami. That would be permitted. Samalei Rova. Rova says, no, there's another factor here that you didn't consider. When there was a small doorway, I could hide from you. In a larger doorway, I can't hide from you. In essence, what he's saying is that when you have the smaller doorway, your angle of vision is diminished. And therefore, if I move to the sides, I can be in private locations where you can't see me through your doorway. Or I can be more careful when you open up your door because it's a smaller angle. But once you open up or widen the doorway, even if you're not taking any more personal space in the chatzer, when you go from 2 to 4, you've now opened up the angle of vision that you have. That reduces the areas that I can use where I'll have privacy. And also, when you open up the door, there's much more exposed, and therefore I'm going to have to be more careful. So the other parties in the chatzer can say that a bigger door does make a difference in terms of your ability to see into the chatzer, or to me losing my privacy, or parts of the chatzer that were private before are now come into the your scope of vision, and therefore it'd be problematic. Echad lo yasenu shnayim. You have one door, you can't split it into two doors. Again, Savar Rami Bar Chama l'meimar, he thought, that's true, ba'arbei lo lishvei trei. That if you have a four amod door, you shouldn't make it into lishvei trei b'nei tarte tarte. You shouldn't take a four amod door, split it into two doors, and make two amod doors. So right now you have this four amod wide door, decide to shut off or brick in half of it, and then open up another door on the other end, further down on your house, that's also two amot wide. So you're going to say, listen, two amot, well, it's the same as the four amot door. But here, you actually will get the kashokyo tamne b'chatzer. You're going to get a bigger grab of personal space in the chatzer. Remember, each door is granted 4x4 amot. So before, where your door was 4 amot wide, you got the width of the door plus a depth of 4 amot. But that is the minimum amount you get in the chatzer. Therefore, if you open up two doorways that are 2 amot wide, you're now going to get two sections of 4x4 amot. So you're going to double your personal space in the chatzer. Before you got 4x4, now you're going to get two patches of 4x4 outside of each door. So you've increased your reach. So therefore, that's when the Mishnah says it's problematic. Aval bar tamnei, if you already have a door, a single door that is 8 wide, l'shavya bnei arbe, shavya dami, to split it into 2 4-amot doors, that should be fine. Because right now you have an 8-amot-wide door, so it's 8 amot wide by 4 amot deep, or the equivalent of 2 4x4 pieces. So now you go and brick up half that door, open up the door further down 4 amot, so now you're just going to get 2 patches of 4x4. It's the same thing as 8x4, maybe that should be fine. I mean, Rava again responds that the reach or your personal space in the chatzer is not the only consideration. I could hide from you. I could keep privacy when you had one doorway. Betray lo matzina itzunim minach. Once you have two doors, I can't keep myself hidden from you. That's again either because before, when the door was locked or closed, I knew I was safe. Now one door could be locked, one could be opened. So now I have a problem. I have to look at or figure out which door is open, which one is locked, or you could appear from either one. Plus, now your scope of vision is increased, because before you only had one location where you could look from. Now you have two locations where you can look from, so it's much harder for me to find angles at points where you can't see me anymore, where I could do my private business within the chatzer. Because of that claim, you're not allowed to both widen the doorway, as well as you can't split your doorway into two doorways, no matter what the size is, because it's not only about the reach into the chatzer, of how much personal space you get in the chatzer, but also about the ability of other parties to have privacy or protect themselves from you coming in or seeing what they are doing. Aval poteach lo rishut haramim, petach keneged petach. You're allowed to open up a doorway directly opposite another doorway when you're rishut haramim. Damalei, sof, habayit itznune mi bnei rishut haramim. Because in the end, you still have to be careful of the bnei rishut haramim. Since there's always going to be traffic outside, forget about me. When I walk out of my door on the opposite side, or I leave my door open and see into your property, you have to worry about all the people traversing the Rishut HaRabim outside. So I make no difference. I add no more problem for you than you had before because of the Rishut HaRabim. Now, a couple things to say about that. That might have changed today a little bit. In their day, once it fell dark, and there were no longer Bnei Rishut HaRabim, there's also no visibility in general because there were no lights there. Today, where lighting extends the visibility both from a street point as well as in the houses, it might be that today there's a difference. During the day, the Bnei Rishut HaRabim are there. At night, or times when the traffic slows down on Shabbat, there's no traffic, then Petach Keneged Petach would be something that maybe you would have to worry about. Obviously, it would all matter about the location and the nature of the traffic that's there, but you could come up with possibilities or scenarios where at certain times of the day there are more people or a huge amount of traffic, and other times of the day there isn't traffic, and then you're opening the door opposite the other party would be injurious in that case. The second thing is that the Rishbam notes over here that this is true of windows as well. The Mishnah says you'll let open a window opposite a window in Rishut HaRabim. He says that that has to do with the riders, people riding horses, people riding a gemalim, camels. So they'll be high up, and they'll be able to look into the windows. Given that, you can open up a window opposite a window because you have the same problem. People who are traversing the Rishut Rabim have the ability to see in, or you have to be private from them. So then your neighbor across the street also can open up a window. It's not going to make a difference. You have two things come from this. Number one is that if it's above the height of any rider or any public exposure, then you would be subject to the rule of you can't open up a window opposite a window, because then the Rishut HaRabim or the B'nai Rishut HaRabim are no longer a factor. The Ramban over here disagrees with the position of the Rishbam and says that that's unusual. It's just not so frequent that you have these horseback riders or these camel riders coming through, so that you can manage in terms of keeping privacy. And in that case, Chalon Nekeneged Chalon would be a problem. We're speaking about the windows here. We're speaking about windows that are level or down at the Rishut HaRabim level, street level windows, or maybe a drop higher where people in the Rishut HaRabim could see it. But these infrequent type of passerbys that are high up, that you don't have to consider to be Rishut HaRabim. And given that, then you would also have to abide by the fact of not opening up a window opposite another window. So that qualifiers about this, when the Rishut HaRabim relieves you of the obligation not to open up a door versus a door, a window opposite a door, that you have to take into consideration the factors of the Rishut HaRabim or the nature of the Rishut HaRabim that is there. Okay, next Mishnah. Ein osim chalal tachat Rishut HaRabim. One may not open up a ditch or a cavern underneath the Rishut HaRabim. That's true of Borot, Shichim, Umearot. Generally, these are water storage holes. So you're not allowed to open up these Magarim, water collection units, underneath the Rishut HaRabim. Whether you dig in through the Rishut HaRabim, or whether you dig in on a lateral basis from under your property into the Rishut HaRabim, both of those are problematic. Rabbi Lezer Matir. Rabbi Lezer says it's fine. Kedei shetei agala melechet bituuna avanim. As long as you've secured the area above, that a camel carrying stones can cross over it, then that would be fine. In essence, what he's saying is, if a tractor trailer could go over that and it would be secure, that would be fine. He's picking the largest animal with the largest load at the time, and he's saying, if you can secure it to the extent that it will not collapse and not be a problem, then you're not causing any problem for the Rishut HaRabim, and then it would be mutar. Whereas the Tanakama says that we're worried about this type of behavior, not because necessarily you're wrong, Rabbi Lazar, but because there is a future possibility of damage, which is that over time, so machloket we saw Rabbi Yochanan Rish Lakish back on Chav Zayin Amud Bet, which is the machloket here premised on whether we go after the here and now, or do we go after the future? Rabbi Lazar focuses on the here and now, and therefore he says right now it's secure. Tanakama says in the future, that security could go away, because things could happen. Over there, the other possibility is that they're arguing about whether we worry about what's called Hitliya Mitocho. Do we worry about it rotting from the inside? It is that there's a deterioration that is not noticeable of the cover, that which is over the bore. The way the Rishbam says that people who are walking over it won't notice that it's deteriorated and then they'll fall in. So do we worry about that aspect, the fact that could be a degradation in these covers? Or do we not worry about degradation in these covers? And that would be machloket between the Tanakama and Rabbi Elazar. Whereas the Rishbam seems to conflate the two issues and brings them both in. It says that do we worry about now and the future? And worrying about the future is whether we worry about the fact that it would deteriorate over time, and therefore there'd be a problem with the cover that's here. And even though, as the Rishbam notes, even if you take full responsibility for anything that happens, that's still not enough of a reason to exempt you from this requirement. Because he says, people don't want to have to end up in court to get their money back. People don't want to be injured and then be compensated. They'd rather just not get injured and not be compensated. And so therefore, based on these reasons that the Gemara noted back on Chav Zayin Amud Bet, Machloket Rabbi Yochanan Reish Lakish, but Reish Lakish says, who is the Tana Nizakim Batar Umdana Dahashta Azlina, that we go after the here and now? Reish Lakish Amar, but Machloket Shnuya, it's a Machloket between Rabbi Elezer and the Chachamim, which is the Machloket in our Mishnah. Rabbi Yochanan Amar, Afilu Teimer Abonon. Even the Rabbanon could agree in our Mishnah. Hatam zimne de machit velavadate. There sometimes it deteriorates and he doesn't focus or he doesn't note it. And again, so the Rashbam brings both of those reasons here, conflates both of those reasons as to the machloket here between the Chachamim, the Tanakama, and Rabbi Eliezer. So now the Mishnah continues and says, Ein motzi'in zizin v'guzuz tera'ot l'rishut rabim. One may not extend out ledges or protrusions, balconies, to the rishut rabim. The guzuz tera'ot are a small premier peset. The zizin are these projections that come out of the house. And again, they were of great utility to the individuals. They could hang things, they could dry things out there. They were very functional and a part of their lives. You can't extend those out to Rishut Rabim because of the problem that you might impede the ability of the people of Rishut Rabim to go by. That's one problem. The second problem is that things could fall off of there and hurt or damage the people in the Rishut Rabim. For that reason, you're not allowed to extend your property or your reach into the Rishut Rabim, because you are now, in essence, stealing from the Rishut Rabim or from the Rabim, because you are taking from the public area and making it into your private domain. So now, that would seem to indicate that the problem only exists when you're impeding the ability of the Rishut Rabim or the Rabim to use the Rishut Rabim. So that would, first of all, maybe limit how high this restriction is, because of the fact that once you're above a certain height, it doesn't bother the people of the Rabim. Although you could argue of the problem of the danger of things falling off and maybe causing or blocking the sun from coming through, then maybe there are other considerations that even if it was up higher than, let's say, a camel and its rider, you still might have restrictions against doing this. Ella imratza, if you want to do this, kones letoch shelo, you back up your property line, umotzi, and then you extend out your balconies and your zizim, whatever you want to put over there, you can do, because now it's in your private property. Over here, again, there's a machloket in the Rishonim as to what rights you garner at that point. When you pull your property line back, in essence, what's going to happen now is that the Rabim are going to take an easement, because they're going to start walking on the property down below. Because you backed up the wall, people, there's no demarcation anymore. People then are going to walk in that area, and they're going to gain an easement. Given the fact that they're going to gain an easement, does that now restrict your ability to put the merpeset or the zizim, those ledges out? You have to keep it above the area where the rabim are going to go. Or can you say, it's my private property, I'll do as I please. You want to come in here, you got to work within my limitations because this is my property. So here even machloket rishonim is whether you're bound by the rules because the rabim is going to extend an easement over there. Or is it your private property? You can do as you please. Lekachatzer, if he bought a property, and it has these ledges and these balconies extending into the Rishut Rabim, that remains in a chazakah, that basically what we assume is that these were built properly originally. The person pulled back the property line and built them in their private property, and therefore you can maintain that status quo. You don't have to all of a sudden take them down because the Rabim is complaining. What the Rashbam quotes is that we're to'anim lelokeach. This is buyer protection. We assume that when the buyer bought it, that the seller had rights and the seller sold them those rights. So we will to'ain, we will claim on behalf of the buyer that this house most likely was pulled back from its property line, even if we don't know that, and even if he has no evidence of that fact. For his protection, we will assume that the seller had moved the property line back and didn't done this with permission. And so unless you can prove otherwise, the assumption is that it was done with permission and he'll be granted that right of permission without having to bring any proof. Whereas the seller himself, if he was coming to establish that right, he would have to bring evidence to the fact that he actually pulled the property line back and built it here. Because he's the current owner and he's the one who extended, he would have to show evidence that he actually did it in his own property line. But once he sells it, this is what we do, to'anim lelokeach. We had this by Chazaka before as well. That once you have 3 years, we're to'anim lelokeach to say that the previous seller already had rights or bought it from whoever it was, and therefore now you can extend that right through the 3 years of Chazaka. So similarly over here, since this easement over the area, which seemingly now belongs to the Rishut Rabim, since it existed before you bought it, we will be to'anim on your behalf that it was put there properly in the first place. All right, so now the Gemara says, V'Rabbanon, why do the Rabbanon disagree with Rabbi Eliezer? Because, Zimnin de Mafkit V'Lava Datei. So this brings the shita of the Rabbi Yochanan back on Chav Zayin Amud Bet, because sometimes it breaks down, and the way that the Rishbam says it, lava date to over b'shut rabim, that the passerby won't realize that there's been a deterioration in the cover, or you could argue it is that the owner won't know that it's deteriorated to replace it. Either way, there's now a injurious situation that has been created in the Rishut Rabbim. And because of that, the Rabbanan don't want you setting up structures like this because of the fact that it will come to be a problem at some point in time. In today's world, we do open up Borot Shichim in Me'arot in the Rishut Rabbim. You have sewers. You have the electric companies. You have the water company. You have Bezek. They all have these manholes that are in Rishut Rabbim. And they cover them with plates that are strong enough to withstand the weight of the heaviest trucks that go by. And we accept that. So there is a Tshuva Darashpa that indicates that this is all about a social contract. The reason that we don't want it is because the Chachamim's assumption here that people do not want to be injured. People don't want people going into the Rishut Rabbim and doing such because of the chances that there are problems. But if we have a social contract and everybody agrees that it's fine to do this, as long as you cover it properly, then that will become the governing rule about this situation. The Mishnah is talking about a default case. But today, where everybody agrees that it's to our benefit to have these items in the Rishut Rabbim, if they're covered properly, then, assuming you cover them properly, then we can't open them up. Obviously not for private use, but for the benefit of the public, we do allow these borot in the Rishut Rabbim. So now the Gemara continues. Ein motzin zizin v'gzuz torot. Rabbi Ami Avale Ziza Davinafik de Mivoa. He had this ledge or this protrusion that went out into a mavoi. V'chau Gavra, Nami Avale Ziza, Davi Maipik the Rishut Rabim. Another individual had a ziz as well, but his extended into the Rishut Rabim. So they both have the same thing. They have this protrusion that goes into an area which is public in nature. That's why on Shabbat the mavoi requires either a lechi or a korah and a shituf mivot, so people don't come to mistake the fact that you can carry in a mavoi, therefore you can carry in Rishut Rabim. So there are similarities between them, which are these are areas that involve a large number of people that traverse that area, that traffic through that area. So Rabbi Ami has it in the mavoi, this other individual has it in the Rishut Rabim. Ata lekamei de Rabbi Ami, so the public came and brought suit to Rabbi Ami over this individual who had his protrusion, his ledge going into the Rishut Rabim. So Amarlei, Rabbi Ami paskins aloha and says, Zilkots, go cut it down. Slice it off. You can't do this. You're impeding the Rishut Rabim, and they're asking for it to be taken down. You have to take it down. Amarlei, v'harmar nami itlei, don't you also have a ziz that goes out into the public area? He says, Didi, limivoa mapik. Mine goes out into a mavoi. B'nei Mivoa Machlin Gabai. The B'nei Mivoa are a limited number of individuals. They may be a large number of individuals, but they are still a quantifiable number of people from whom I can ask Michila or permission to do this. So I got permission from all the parties that are involved. Didach, the Rishut Rabim, Meipik, Man Machil Gabich. Yours is going out into the Rishut Rabim. Over there, you can't get the acquiescence of the public at large. It's just too large a number of people. That is both because it's the people that are local to the area, but it might be anybody who uses this street because it belongs to the public at large, and you can never get the permission at the public at large. There are exceptions to this rule. The Gemara deals with it in other places about possibly Shiva Tuvei Yair. If there are representatives of the city that represent the public at large, then they might be able to waive the right or grant rights. And that if you have a legislature that represents the public, then maybe, or a town council, maybe over there you could do this, and you could have approvals made by the public or for the public at large. But at least in the situation here, what Rabbi Ami is saying is, in the Mavoi, I dealt with the individuals, because there are individuals. It may be many individuals, but still individuals. When you deal with the Rishut Rabim, you're dealing with the public at large, you're no longer dealing with a quantifiable number of individuals from whom you could ask permission to do this. And that's why there's a difference in the din over here. Rabbi Yanai Avile Ilan Anotel Rishut Rabim. Yanai had a tree that leaned over into the Rishut Rabim, meaning part of its branches were extending into the Rishut Rabim. How about Gavra? Avile Nami Ilan Anotel Rishut Rabim. There was another individual who had the same problem, which is that he had a tree that extended into Rishut Rabim. Adu b'nei Rishut Rabim, Abu Kamak ve'ilavei. They were bothered, or they wanted to bring a class action suit, that this individual's tree was impeding their flow in Rishut Rabim, or their ability to use the Rishut Rabim. Ata l'kamei de Rabbi Yanai. So they came to Rabbi Yanai to adjudicate the case. They wanted him to compel this individual to cut down the branches that extended into the Rishut Rabim. And obviously he wanted to keep his tree the way it was before. So Amar Luhu, Rabbi Yanai says to them, Zila idna batala machar. Go away today, let me think about it. Come back tomorrow and I'll give you a psak. I will conclude the case. Belelia, overnight, Shadar katse the haudidide. Overnight he went and cut his tree down, meaning that he cut the branches of his tree that extended into the Rishut Rabim. The Machar Atta Lekamei, litigants came before him again the next day. Amalei, so now Rabbi Yanai said to the other individual whose tree was extending to the Rishut Rabim, Zilkots, go cut it down. Amalei, the individual responds to Rabbi Yanai, Hamar Nami Yitlei, don't you also have a tree that extends to the Rishut Rabim? I'm no different than you. Why are you giving up Psak to take mine down if you have the same issue? So Amalei, Zilchazi, says, I'll make you a deal. Ikots Didi, if mine is cut down, kots didach, you'll cut yours down. Ilo kots didi, mine's not cut down, lo tikots at, you don't have to cut yours down. So obviously he had preemptively taken care of the problem because he already cut his tree, the other unbeknownst to this individual. And so now when he goes out to look at it, he's going to see that Rabbi Yanai's tree is cleared out, and he's going to have to cut his. Now he's not going to argue now because he's going to say, oh, I'm in good standing. Rabbi Yanai has a tree there, I'm not going to have to cut mine down. He all of a sudden he walks out of Beit Din and all realizes that Rabbi Yanai's tree is not extending there. And that will bring the solution to a conclusion, which is that he will have to cut it down. So Gemara says, Mi'ikara, my savar, Udasof, my savar. Rabbi Yanai's position is a little bit difficult. Because Rabbi Yanai, at first, allowed his tree to grow into the Rishut Rabim. Then, all of a sudden, his case comes before him. And now, based on the complaints or the class action brought by the Rabim, he's going to force, compel this individual to take it down. So he preemptively takes his down. So Gemara wants to know, what was he thinking originally that he allowed his tree to grow into the Rishut Rabim? And why now, all of a sudden, does he say, oh, can't do it, I gotta cut it down? What changed his mind? Mikara Savar originally thought, Nechalu the Bnei Rishut Rabim diyatve bitulei. He thought that he was providing a service for the Rishut Rabim. Yes, his tree might be somewhat of an impediment to the Rishut Rabim. That's both because maybe the branches were blocking, or there were fruits or leaves falling into the Rishut Rabim that were causing debris to be there. But nevertheless, there was a offsetting benefit, which is there was shade provided by the tree to the Bnei Rishut Rabim. So they might have been happy to have shade, especially in Israel, where the sun beats down pretty hard. Having shade would have been a nice benefit. So he thought that that was a mitigating factor that allowed the tree to stay there. Came into Chazab to Kama Akve, when he saw that Bnei Rishut Rabim were bringing suit against the other party, Shadar Katsya. Then he went and cut it down because he realized that the detriment to the Bnei Rishut Rabim exceeded the benefit they were garnering from the shade. So why did they come to Rabbi Yanai? That's what Rabbi Yanai figures out, that they weren't saying anything to Rabbi Yanai out of respect, which is that, truthfully, they wanted him to cut it down a lot earlier, but because out of respect that it was Rabbi Yanai, they didn't say anything. As soon as another party came and had the same issue, they brought him to court. So Rabbi Yanai realized that until now they were just keeping silent, not because they were benefiting from it, but rather because they were out of respect for him, they didn't say anything. Once he figured that out, he cut it down right away and said that that's not what the Rishut Rabim want, or Bnei Rishut Rabim want. Falei Malei, why didn't Rabbi Yanai wait and say, Zil Kots Didach, Vadar Akots Didi? Why didn't he set up the structure in this way, which is, I still think, as I mentioned before, it was a brilliant move, because he basically got the guy to acquiesce to the solution, thinking that Rabbi Yanai still had a tree out there, and then when he realizes it's not, he's in a bind, and he's going to have to cut his tree down. But despite that, or even given that, Gemara wants to know, why didn't Rabbi Yanai only take action after he gave up sack for this guy? He'll say, you cut yours down, I'll cut mine down, and Rabbi Yanai could have been in just as good standing. The answer is, because of Mishum Deresh Lakish, that which Reish Lakish says, Damar, Reish Lakish says, Hit Koshushu Vekoshu. You should first do it for yourselves, and then do for others. Shot Atzmecha, make yourself upstanding. V'achar kach shot acherim. And then afterwards, make sure that other people are straightened out. Again, the word kshot can either be from the word shoth, which means to be upright, or shoth can mean from the word truth, meaning that make yourself honest and then make other people honest, or in essence, don't give tochacha to others unless you have a clean slate, or those that are in glass houses shouldn't throw stones, all the expressions that go along with this, which is that he had to have a clean slate before he could demand of this other individual to do it. The way it's learned out is either because hitkoshu b'koshu is very similar in nature to hitkoshu and kashot. The two words are similar in nature. The truth is that they are completely different shorashim, but the Chazal sometimes will do that, play on the words, even though they're not exactly the same. Although the Rashbam does over here say that there is a fundamental understanding here, which is hitkoshu means haser hakash, remove the chaff. The truth is, in the pasuk, hitkoshu means gather the chaff or gather this stuff together. And even in that context, it could be read in the similar way that the Gemara is reading it, which is a hitkoshu. According to the Rashbam, it means remove the chaff, remove that which is bad. So he thinks it's directly correlated. Hitkoshu, kakoshu means remove the bad and then remove the other person's bad. And he sees that as it being almost the kshot as an explanation for what's being said in the pasuk. But if you read the literal meaning of the pasuk, which is hitkoshu, gather for yourself, koshu, and then gather for others, it still would have the same meaning, which is that the pasuk demands or it tells you to do yourself first and then deal with others. So that's similar even on the airplane where they say, first put on your own oxygen mask, then put on the oxygen mask of the people with you, which is this idea. You gotta take care of yourself first in order that you have the capability to deal with others. That's both in a positive and a negative sense. If you don't rectify what you're doing wrong, then you can't demand of others to do it. If you don't take care of yourself and keep yourself healthy and good standing, you're not gonna be able to help others that need your help. So that idea of itkoshu koshu, even if you don't say that the literal translation is what Chazal is saying, the meaning or the feeling that is given by the pasuk would also result in the same explanation or concept, which is kshot atzmecha v'acharka kshot acherim. All right. Aval imratza, if a person wants kones l'toch shelo o motzi, that he can move his property line back and then put out these ledges and these balconies. Ibailu kanas v'lo hotzi. What happens if he moved the property line back with the intention of putting in these ledges, these balconies, but he didn't get around to it? V'lo hotzi. He never got around to it. Ma'u shi'achzor v'yotzi. After some time has elapsed, does he have a right then to extend the ledge and the balconies? Meaning this is his private property, and he's pulled the property line back with the intention of using that for his benefit, but for whatever reason, he ran out of money, he was busy, he didn't do it then. In the interim, the Rabbim gained an easement over there because the Rishut the Rabbim basically extended into his property. Now he wants to go put in his ledges and his Gezuz Terot, which you're not allowed to do, into the areas of the Rabbim. So now he's in a catch-22. It's his property, but because they gained an easement, he can't put it out. So what do we say? Do we say that he did in the originally, he pulled it back the property line and he had that intent and therefore he retained that right? Or do we say that once that right's been given up to the Rabbim, you can't take it back? So Yochanan Amar, Kanas Motzi, if he does pull the property line back and then waits, he can extend the ledges and the Gezuz Terot later. Rish Lakish Amar, Kanas Einu Motzi. Once the Rabbim has gained an easement over here, you can't go back and extend or put out those Izimik Gezuz Terot, because you've lost your rights to the Rabbim. Amar Rabbi Yaakov, the Ramiri of Bar Tachlifa, Aspera lecha lotzi kuliyama lo plige. So now the Gemara, or the way that Rabbi Yaakov is reading it, he's rereading this machloki between Reish Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan and saying, everybody agrees to motzi, that you can put it out. If you pull back in here, it's your private domain that you've granted an easement to the Rabbi, you retain your rights to have the zizim and zuzerot put out later. Ki plige lachazir k'talim limkoman. The machloket is whether you can re-extend your walls back to their former location. The ipcha itmar. And the positions of Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish are actually reversed. Rabbi Yochanan amar inu machzir. You have no right to return the walls to their original position. Reish Lakish amar machzir. You do have a right to return your walls to the original position. Rabbi Yochanan amar inu machzir mishum de Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yochanan says you may not return the walls to the original position because of Rabbi Yehuda. Tam Rabbi Yehuda, Meitzar, Sheziku Bo Rabbim. If there is this path that the Rabbim have extended an easement on, asur lekalkolo. You have no right to ruin it or take it away. Shlaka shamar, magzir. Shlaka says you do have a right to turn the walls to their original position. Hani mila echa deleka ravcha. That's in a place where there is no alternative or there's no other space. Hacha ha'ika ravcha. Over here there is alternate space. So let's take this piece by piece. First of all, the reason that Rabbi Yaakov flips the positions of Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish is because the halacha is like Rabbi Yehuda. Since the halacha is like Rabbi Yehuda, he wants to align Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Yehuda's positions because he wants the halacha to be like Rabbi Yochanan, which is the case when Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish argue the halacha is like Rabbi Yochanan, with the exception of the cases mentioned in the Gemara. So therefore, he wants Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Yehuda to align their din, even though Reish Lakish doesn't necessarily argue on Rabbi Yehuda, but it makes it smoother if you have Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Yehuda aligning. That's number one. Number two is, what Rabbi Yaakov does over here is, first of all, says that, in terms of your maintaining your right, you have to cede a right to the Reshut Rabbim for them to have an easement. Over here, yes, you gave them the property. They are walking over there, but you still retained your right to extend your ledges and gzuz the road, and everybody agrees that you still maintain that right. You moved into your private property. That gained you that right, and you haven't forfeited that right. You have not exercised it yet, but you still have that right. Now, the question of moving the wall back has to do with an easement. The case that they're bringing from Yehuda is a case where we have two fields, and in between the fields, the Rabbim basically created a path that they walked through on a regular basis. So it became a de facto Shvila Rabbim, a place where the Rabbim traverses, and you can't take that back. They've extended an easement over there. Of course, that's only if you did it with permission at first. You can't trespass and then create an easement. It has to be that they had permission. But what happens is the individual who has a field on the left side of the road ends up buying the field on the right side of the road. Before it was two different owners, so they didn't mind that there was this path between them. All of a sudden there's a consolidation of ownership and he owns the fields on both sides. He now wants to close the path down so he can plow and he can work the fields as one big field. You can't do that. That's what Rabbi Yehuda says. The Rabbim already gained an easement. You can't take it away from them. What Reish Lakish is saying over here is that the easement there is different than the easement here. The easement over there is that's the only path. That's the only way through. If he shuts that path down by extending his fields or consolidating his fields, the Rabbim has no way to go through there anymore. They're going to have to walk all the way around, and he's going to undermine their easement. Over here, the Rabbim already have a Reshut Rabbim that exists. All he did was give them more room, but that's like almost an extension on what is an existing Reshut Rabbim. So when he puts his property line back to the original state, he hasn't really confiscated anything from the Rabbim. He has taken back what is his, but the Rabbim still has the Reshut Rabbim that's there. Obviously, Rabbi Yochanan disagrees and says, once the Rabbim gained an easement, that expanded road is now theirs, belongs to them, and you can't close it back down. You can't go back once the easement has been created. And again, I always note this, that if you go through, walk through the streets of New York, there are many stores at the corner that have their doors on an angle. And over there, there's a plaque in the ground that says that even though we grant permission for people to walk across here, nevertheless, we're not extending an easement. We are objecting to the creation of an easement over here so that if they ever wanted to build the building and square it out again, the property that's there belongs to them and is not taken by the Rabbim. That's the only way you could do this, which is that, for instance, if you pulled your property line back and then put up obstacles that people couldn't walk over there, you could prevent the Rabbim from taking possession of it. But you'd have to object. If you just open it up and just leave it and the Rabbim starts to use it, they will gain an easement in that case. Said here, if you purchase the property and already has these items that are extending into the Reshut Rabbim, we assume that it was done with permission. Amrav Huna, nafla, if the place falls down, chuzer ubone uta. You have a right to go and rebuild it. So the chazaka here is not just a chazaka for the existing building, it's a chazaka that allows you to recreate or replicate that which is there. So we assume that it is real permission that was granted over here, and if you go to rebuild it, you rebuild it with the same dimensions and with the same permissions or rights that you had before. Meitave, is that really true? Ein misaydin, vein michayrin, vein mifayachin bizman hazeh. One is not permitted to make these decorative improvements to their house these days. The reason being, because we'll see in a second, is mishum evel beit hamikdash. It is zecher the churban, and therefore one cannot finish their house in a complete way You must not do it to the utmost beauty, because we are still under the pall of the Churban HaBayit, and it would be inappropriate to have a house with that type of beauty. And so therefore, in misaydin, misaydin is this whitewash to make it super white. Ve'ein michayrin, the way that the Rashbam reads it is that can't make shapes or pictures out of this sid, out of this type of wash or plaster that goes on top. Ve'ein mifaychin is that you can't make these decorations or designs with colors. So these are restrictions of what you can do in the house. Lakach chaser misuyedet michuyeret mifuyechet. If you purchased a house that already had all of these items completed in it. So here is a restriction against doing this if you're building a new house. What happens if you purchase a house and all of this is existing already? Harizo b'chazkata. We assume that the chazaka exists, that it was done with permission. There are two ways it could be done with permission. The house pre-existed the Churban HaBayit, or you bought it from a non-Jew, or a Jew who you're buying it from bought it from a non-Jew originally. So those are the ways that could have been done beheter. So here where the buyer buys it, we assume that the reason it's done this way is because it either pre-existed the Churban, or it was in the hands of a goy at some point when it was built, and therefore it didn't have this requirement. Nafla, if it falls down, eino chozero boneuta. You don't have a right to rebuild it with that chazakah. So here you have a difference in din. So the din by us is that you have these rights. We don't know if you really have them. We assume there's a chazakah, and we give you the chazakah that they were done with permission. House falls down, we let you reassert those rights when you rebuild it. Here, by the case of the Zecher de Churban, you have a situation in which the chazakah exists, and we assume it was done beheter. The house falls down, and now you're rebuilding the house. We don't give you that right to rebuild it with those existing rights. We say that you may not do what was restricted. So why is there a difference over here? Isura, shiny. Isur is different. We're dealing with two different issues. You're dealing with Isur, and you're dealing with Dinei Mamononot, the way that the Rashbam explains it. We're dealing with Hezek over there, by the Shuter Abim. But you're dealing, the basic distinction is Isur and Mamon. When you're dealing with Mamon, then your rights that you gain through the Chazakah, you continue to assert those rights, even after the house falls down, because in essence, you own the rights. The Isur over here has to do with whether it was done with permission, or was done without permission. So until this point in time, we assume it was done with permission. Once the house falls down and you're building it again, what does the previous fact that it was done with permission or properly have to do with what you're building now? You're building a new house. If you're building a new house, you got to do what is appropriate now. Now, that is either because the chazakah is not going to work anymore because we're dealing with Isur, or a more basic way to say it is, you're starting from scratch. If you're starting from scratch, the rules apply to you, and you can't say, oh, it was done by Heter before, now I own that right. It's not a right. It's an issue whether it was Heter or Isur. The Isur applies now because you're the one building the building. Now, Tanu Rabbanan. Lo yisod adam et beito b'sid. Person may not plaster his house with the white sid. The problem here is it makes it nice because it is the finishing touch where they make it super white. If you don't do that, then the walls are uneven, the walls have a certain amount of darkness to them, and that's what we're trying to create. We're trying to have an effect of having something that is not as aesthetically pleasing as you would have liked, because of Zecher the Churban HaBayit. Vimi reiv v'chol oteven mutar. He mixes in sand or straw, then it is mutar. The idea being that the sand or the straw diminishes the whiteness of the plaster or the whitewash. And given that, it would be permissible because you don't get the same effect or aesthetic effect of the whitening. So that's why it would be permitted. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Irei Bochol Arizid Tar Kasid Vasur Teven Mutar. He differentiates between what you mix in there. If you mix in sand, he says it's called Tarkasid. Obviously, it includes the word sid, but it's a tarkasid, which means that it's some sort of subpar sid, but it's still white enough that we classify it as being a finishing touch. Whereas if you put in straw in there, that already diminishes the quality significantly enough that we would consider that to be okay. Tarabanan, kishicharav habayit vishniya. Once the second Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, Rabu Prushim b'Yisrael. There were many prushim amongst Bnei Yisrael. Prushim are those that stick to the law, but are parush. They separate themselves out. And over here, they were not necessarily separating themselves out from Tuma, but here they were separating themselves out from the benefits or joys of the world. Not to eat meat and not to drink wine. The idea being that when it came to the Korban HaBayit, an integral part of the Avodah was the Korbanot and the Nesoch HaYayin. And therefore they felt that once the Korban HaBayit took place, that it would be inappropriate to enjoy Basar V'Yayin. Now you can see this on different levels, because we actually have this by the 9 days, which is that there are two reasons not to partake in Basar V'Yayin. One reason is the joy that comes from Basar V'Yayin. The other one is Zecher the Korbanot or the Korban HaBayit. So over here, they could be for both reasons that they don't want to partake of the Basar V'Yayin. They feel like that Basar V'Yayin is the type of simcha that would be inappropriate in the shadow of Korban HaBayit. Or they're saying that Basar V'Yayin's primary purpose was to be used in the service of the Mikdash. So when the service of the Mikdash is going on, then to eat Basar V'Yayin over here would be okay. But if there's no service in the Mikdash, Basar V'Yayin have lost their primary purpose, then their secondary purpose or their tertiary purpose should also be forfeited, and we shouldn't be able to benefit from the Basar V'Yayin. Nitpal lahem Rabbi Yoshua. Rabbi Yeshua decided to take them on and show them that their ways were inappropriate. Mar lahem banai, mipnei ma iatem ochlim basar viatem shotim yayin. Said, why don't you eat meat? Why don't you drink wine? Amru lo nochal basar shmimenu makrivim agave mizbeach. How can we eat meat which was brought on the mizbeach? Vachshav batel, and now there's no longer any avoda going on. Nishte yayin shminaschin agave mizbeach. Then we're going to drink the wine that was poured as a libation on the altar of Achshav Batel, and now it no longer is extant. So that's the point, that the contrast between what happened in the time of the Mikdash and now makes it that we will not partake in Basar V'Yayin for one of the two reasons that we mentioned. Either because the only permission is because we use it in the Mikdash, therefore we're permitted to eat it as Chulin. That's the way that it's expressed in the Torah. It says, Kiryachak Mimcha Makom. When you're too far away from the Mishkan and the Mikdash to being korbanot, and you want to eat basar, that's what we give you shchita for. That's what we give you the laws of shchita for basar chulin. But what you see from the Torah is that the best way, or the primary way to eat basar, is through the korbanot. It's only that we give a permission because it's going to be too far away, it's going to be too much of a burden, that if we say that any time you want to eat meat, you got to bring a korban, people are not going to be able to deal with that. So the Torah gives you special permission when you're further away from the Mikdash to eat basar, even though it's not a korban. But it still becomes a derivative of the korbanot, because shchita, which is basically associated with kedusha and the korbanot, is now taken into the world of chulin. So basically what we've done is taken the world of kedusha and korbanot and brought it over to the world of chulin. For that reason, number one, you do it through shchita, which is a law of korbanot. Plus, you cannot eat the blood, because the blood from a korban goes on the mizbeach. The blood of chulin you can't utilize or you can't have. And the chalavim also, and the fats that go on the mizbeach, you can't partake of those in a behemat chulin. So many of the laws that apply to korbanot are then taken over and applied by basar chulin. But that shows you that basar chulin is really just a derivative of basar kodoshim. And it's only really the basar kodoshim that's permitted. Chulin is only permitted under the shadow of the basar kodoshim. So that's one reason why they may not have wanted to eat the meat and the wine. The other reason might be what we said before, that basar v'yayin are associated with simcha. That's why they are integral to the simchat yom tov. Your meals on yom tov have to include basar v'yayin, because that's integral to the din of simchat yom tov. So for both of those reasons, they were unwilling. Amar lahem imkein lechem lo nochal. Let us not eat bread. Kshekvar batluma nachot. The meal offerings of the Mikdash are no longer extant. So why are you eating bread? The flour and the water and all that was made in the menachot, that is now batel. You shouldn't be eating any bread. They said, fine, you're right. They took his hara and they said, you're right. Efshar beperot. We'll eat fruits from now on. No more bread. Not only no more basar v'yayin, no more bread. Perot lo nochal. So then he says to them, all right, you're eating fruit now. We shouldn't eat fruits. Shvar batlu bikurim. Bikurim, we're used to bringing up the bikurim to the Mikdash. There's no more service of the bikurim anymore, so we shouldn't eat fruits. Efshar beperot acherim. They said, okay, you're right, we accept your he'ara. We won't eat any of the shivat haminim anymore, because that's what the bikurim come from. Other fruits we will eat. It says, ma'im lo nishta. We shouldn't drink any water. Shvar batel nisuch hamayim. Because the water libations are no longer in service. So we should also not drink water, because that would be a reminder of the water in the Mikdash. Shatku. They were left silent. They realized that if you take this to its end, you can end up in a situation in which you cannot eat anything. Now the Baalei Tosafot point out that it's not exactly true, because with water, there's only certain water that is mutar, or is good for being put on the Mizbeach. It has to come from a Mayan, it has to come from a Mei Chaim. So what if you had cistern water, that would not be qualified for Nisuch HaMayim, so you should be able to drink it. Also, you could drink other things. You could drink fruit juices instead of water. Why don't they answer that? So the Baalei Tosafot over here suggests, and it says, V'omeri, the davar davi mimin shosim bo nisuch chashiv kemo davar atzmo. That anything that's within the same category is classified as being problematic, just like by the yayin. By the yayin, they didn't say only yayin that is ra'oi l'mizbeach you can't drink, but yayin that's not ra'oi l'mizbeach you could drink, because then you could eat, you could drink yayin mevushal. You don't see them saying that. So you see that they assert all yayin, and not just yayin that is ra'oi l'mizbeach. So similarly, by the mayim, they weren't just oser the mayim that could go on the mizbeach, they were oser mayim legamre. But given that, you don't have any alternative. Tosafot says you do have an alternative, you could drink fruit juices. So he says over here that he doesn't think that they would have lasted. It was just too much to drink fruit juice for the rest of their lives. They wouldn't be able to deal without water. So Amar lehem banai bovo mer lechem. Let me explain to you what you should be doing over here. Let me explain to you what is the proper conduct or proportions in which this should be done. Shelo litabel kol ikar, to not be in mourning at all, yefshar. That is impossible. Kshvar nigzera gzera. Because the gzera already came about, as the Hashbam says, nigzera gzera churban abayit. Nitchayvu litabel. And therefore we are obligated to mourn over the loss of the bayit, over the gzera. Uleitabel yoter midai yefshar. But to mourn in a too fervent extent where it's beyond the capabilities of the public to keep these dinei avelut, you can't do. She'in gozvin gzera letzibur, elein kein rov etzibur yocholim lamod ba. You cannot institute practices that the public at large is not going to be able to maintain. A practice is only a good practice when the public at large can maintain the practice, and therefore it'll be kept in service or it'll be maintained. Dichtiv, because the pasuk says, Bimeira atem ni'arim, v'oti atem kovim hagoi kulo. Here they're quoting a pasuk from the third parak in Malachi. The third parak in Malachi is Minyan HaDiyoma, because that is the Haftorah that we read on Shabbat HaGadol. And over there in the Haftorah, in Malachi Dimo, it says, L'mimei avotechem sartem mechukai. From the days of your forefathers, you've left my laws. V'lo shemartem, and you haven't kept them. Shuvei elai, return to me. V'ashuvei aleichem, amar Hashem Tzvakot. And Hashem says, if you return to me, I will return to you. V'amartem b'men ashuv. God says rhetorically, you want to know how to do tshuva? Ha'ikba adam elukim, ki atem kovim oti. Is it possible for man to steal from God that you are stealing from me? V'amartem b'mek v'anucha. And God says, you want to know how you're stealing from me? Ha'maser v'atshuma. You're not giving your tithes, and that's how you're stealing to me. You're not giving your masrot and your trumot. B'me'ira atem ni'arim, ve'otei atem kovim agoi kulo. So the simple translation of the pasuk is that you're living under this curse, and the entire nation is stealing from me. Don't you realize the correlation between the curse that has fallen upon you and the fact that you are stealing from me? Haviu kol masar beit otzar. Bring all your tithes to the storehouses. And then there will be salvation or what to eat in my house. And then when you find favor in my eyes in doing this, Hashem says, at that point, then I will open up the storehouses of the heavens, and I will give you a bracha without any limits. So Hashem says, if you do tshuva and you rectify your ways, then I will grant you the bracha because you will no longer be stealing from me. So here the Gemara reads, "Bimeira atem ni'arim The way that the Rashbam reads it is, Kibaltem aleichem gzeriat arur. You accepted upon yourselves with the gzera of a curse, lavia maser el beit ha'otzar, to bring the tithes to the beit ha'otzar. So the way that the Rashbam is reading it is not Hashem saying, b'meiratim ne'arim, that meiratim ne'arim is not a promise, but rather it's a fact that the pashtut of pasuk is that you are under the curse because you are stealing from me. Whereas the way that the Rashbam's reading it now, based on the Gemara's interpretation, is b'meira atim ne'arim, is you actively have put a curse, or as if you've taken a neder that involves a curse, bring that which is obligated on you, and nevertheless, you're still stealing from me. You're still not abiding by the rules or the nedarim that you accepted upon yourselves. And that's why you're now subject to the me'iraz, because you accepted it. But based on that, it says b'meira atim ne'arim, and the end of the pasuk is a goy kulo. And so now they associate the two together, which is that when the goy kulo can be subject to b'meira atim ne'arim, that when they accept this curse upon themselves, they accept an obligation, it only works when goy kulo, when the whole nation is involved. And then they go on to say that rubo kikulo, that rove is like the whole, and therefore only if the rove of the individuals can maintain the tzeirah, the takanah that the chachamim put in place, is it binding. But if the people at large cannot keep the takanat chachamim or the isur that the chachamim are instituting, it does not work. It is not effective. Now here, the Rishonim discuss what exactly is the measuring mark for that. The Rambam actually has two different formulations of this, which is one, this has to be a serious consideration in any takanat chachamim, which is that you may not put a gzera or takana in place if you think that the Rov HaKahal will not be able to maintain it. Now, if you go ahead and put an gzera in place and thinking that the Rov HaKahal can do it, after it was put in place, the people don't abide by it, and therefore it does never reaches an extent by which it's accepted by the majority of the people, or is it b'teila, the Rambam says, v'einan rishayim l'kufet am l'lechet ba. It is annulled by itself, it terminates by itself, and the Beit Din or the Chachamim cannot compel the individuals to abide by it. So there is a test period in which the Chachamim or the Beit Din establishes a takana gzera. If the Rov HaKahal accept it and it becomes widely accepted, then you can maintain it, or then it goes into effect. If it doesn't have that outcome, then it automatically terminates or is annulled because the Rov HaTzibur didn't accept it or unwilling to accept it, and therefore it is batel. Then the Rambam brings another case, which is a case where they put the gzera in place and they thought that it extended to Rov Klal Yisrael. They assumed that it worked. People were keeping it and they thought the Rov kept it. Then, years later, they go and do a survey, and they start to realize that nobody is keeping this takanat chachamim or this gzera of the chachamim. At that point, the Beit Din is allowed to annul the gzera. Even though generally, we say based on the Gemara and Beit Zah, that only a Beit Din that is greater in chokhmah and minyan can unwind or undo a gzera or takanat of a previous Beit Din. Over here, the Rambam says that even a smaller Beit Din or a lower Beit Din can unwind that which was done by a greater Beit Din in the past because of the weakness of this takanat gzera. What the Rambam basically says is that the fact that we see now that it's not being kept amongst Rov HaKahal, that already weakens the gzera. It doesn't simply terminate or annul itself because at some point they thought it was in place. But given now that the people have, now we checked and we realize that they're not keeping it, or it hasn't extended to Rov HaKahal, it's a weakened form of the gzera, and therefore even a weaker, quote-unquote, Beit Din can unwind the gzera, the takana, of a previous Beit Din. And that's why the Radbaz mentions that in the Gemara in Avodah Zorah, when they put into place certain isurim like patakum, bishulakum, yenakum, they put all those in place. There was also a gzera of shemenakum. But the Gemara there says that the shemenakum never took hold, or never became extant in Rov HaKahal. And the Rabbah says that's why Rabbi Yehuda came along and was matirit. He unwound it, he annulled that gzerah. So the Rabbah says that's why they needed a Beit Din to unwind the gzerah of Shemen, because when you have a gzerah that's put in place and the Rov HaKahal doesn't accept it, it's not terminated or annulled by itself. You require a Beit Din to unwind it. So while he seemingly accepts the Rambam here about the lack of a public at large accepting the Gzeirah, the Rabbah seems to require in all instances that a Beit Din unwind what a previous Beit Din did. And that's why they unwound the Gzeirah of Shemen, even though it never was widely accepted by the people. And in that way he conflates the two positions of the Rambam and says that both of them require the unwinding of the Beit Din. On the other hand, there are those that say that that's not the case. The Lecha Mishnah discussing it shows or brings that the Rambam differentiates and does not require the unwinding of the Gzeirah by a Beit Din in cases where it was annulled immediately or it never took hold. It was only where they were under the misconception that it took hold that the Rambam requires that reversal. And so then the Lecha Mishnah says, okay, even if you think that that's what the Rambam says, minayin lo that. Where did the Rambam come up with this differentiation between whether something was never accepted or there was a misconception that it was accepted? Where do you come up with this difference in a din? And so he says that that's because of what happened by the Shemen. The Rambam was bothered by the fact that by the Shemen they required a Beit Din to unwind it, even though it was never accepted by the Rov HaKahal. That drove the Rambam to create this distinction that there are some times where you require a Beit Din to unwind the Takanag Gzeirah, and other times where it's annulled or terminates by itself. And that distinction derives from the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, and that is the source for this distinction that is brought by the Rambam. And you can see that in the Rishonim over here in Baba Batra, like the Ritva over here, says that if they were Gozer, and it wasn't accepted by the public at large, in a Gzeirah Kalau, it's self-terminating, it's annulled automatically, and you don't need any intervention to annul it. So the Rambam's addition of this extra category comes from the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, which speaks about the Beit Din of Rabbi Yehuda unwinding the Gzeirah of Shemen. And so then he has to speculate as to why there they needed it and not over here. And in doing so, he comes up with that bifurcation of the din between different types of rejections by the tzibur, a case where it's rejected and known to be rejected outright, versus a case where there's a misconception that was accepted and later they discover that the Rov HaKahal does not abide by it. Now, as far as the Mayim is concerned, that we saw here that Rabbi Yeshua was suggesting to the Prushim that they shouldn't drink water, over here, the Torah Chaim says that that might have been Me'ikar Adin, because it derives from the Pasuk of Imeshkachech Yerushalayim Tishkach Yemini, Tikbak Lushoni Lechiki Imlo Ezkerechi, Imlo Alet Yerushalayim Asro Simchati. He says that the Tikbak Lushoni Lechiki, that my tongue should stick to its palate, might be an indication of the lack of water. I mean that it's right, it's proper and right not to drink water over the Churban HaBayit because of the fact that the Pasuk says your tongue is going to stick to its palate from remembering Yerushalayim. Now that's not the simplest reading of the Pasuk. The reading of the Pasuk seems to indicate that Tibak Lashon Echeki, if I don't remember Yerushalayim, he's now reading that as the obligation. The obligation to remember Yerushalayim is Tibak Lashon Echeki, that my tongue should be stuck to the palate from the dryness of my mouth. And he says that's the source for the fact that it was proper not to drink water, or that might have been what you thought was demanded by the Pasuk of Tikvak Lushoni Lechiki in the remembrance of the Churban HaBayit. In addition, over here, the Chatam Sofer makes a point about the fact that here it says Bishnia, that this practice, these practices were only something that was relevant after the Churban HaBayit HaSheni. And he asks, why didn't they have these practices after the Churban HaBayit HaRishon? After Churban HaBayit HaRishon, we only find in Nevi'im the requirement for the Arba Tzomot, the four fast days that we have during the year, Zecher the Churban, but it was the only commemoration that they have with regards to the Churban HaBayit HaRishon. Why didn't they have all the practices that are mentioned here? Or the other question is the other way around. Why don't the four fasts suffice for Churban HaBayit Sheni? Why do we need these additional practices that are Zecher the Churban? And the Chabtam Sofer answers because there's a difference in the nature of the Churban. Churban HaBayit HaRishon was for a limited time, a limited scope. It was for 70 years. Therefore, it was sufficient to have the four tzomot. On the other hand, the Churban HaBayit HaSheni has no prediction as to how long it will last. And given that there is no prediction, that means that every day is a possible day where the Bayit could be rebuilt. And on any day that the Bayit's not rebuilt, Then the midrash that we say all the time, any person shelo nivneta b'yamav, if the bayit is not built in his day, kilu nechrava b'yamav, it's as if it's destroyed on that day. And therefore the Chatam Sofer says that every day is a day that is ra'oi, or it's considered to be an avelut for the churban, because it's as if every day the korban bayit takes place over and over again. And given that, there needed to be something that was a daily reminder about the korban bayit. It wasn't enough with the Arba Tzomot that were sufficient by the Bayit HaRishon. Although then he quotes from the Maharam Al-Moshininu, who says that out of the Pasuk of, from Yeshayahu, of Simchu et Yerushalayim Begilu Ba, Kol Ovea, Sisu Ita Masos Kol Mitablim Aleha, that those that mourn for Yerushalayim, Sisu Ita Masos, they should rejoice with it. The Pasuk seems to be saying that those that mourn the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash will also be zoche in the future to see the sason and the simcha of the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash. But the Chatam Sofer brings in the name of the Maharam Al-Shaninu that there seems to be a necessity in the present to both be ba'avilut and b'simcha, which is that the pasuk is written in a present tense, which is sisi tamasos kol amitavim alea, that one will rejoice, those that are mourning over it. Maram Al-Moshanino says that if it were not for the fact that we maintain the Avelut, then we would forget and we would stop remembering the Churban HaBayit. He doesn't say this, but I would add on to that. It's the same concept that has to do with Zikaron, or remembering things once a year, like Mechiyat Amalek, which the Chatam Sofer explains that there is a principle that is brought in the Gemara in Brachot, that one of the brachot in the world is that hamet nishtakach min alev, that someone who's passed away, over time, the pain and the sorrow and the person are forgotten, which is a bracha that allows the person to continue. Because once you have resigned or given up hope on that individual, the person who's alive can continue on and then can rebuild their life going forward. But if the mate was not nishtakach min alev, if he wasn't forgotten, then the individual would never be able to move forward from that loss or from that devastation. So over here, what you would suggest over here is the same thing, which is that if we made the Beit HaMikdash as something that's dead, then nishtakach min alev, we would forget about it. And it would be appropriate to forget about it because it's something in the past, not something relevant to the present and the future. On the other hand, if you believe that the Beit HaMikdash is still something that is relevant to us, and then something that will be rebuilt, then it's appropriate that we don't forget about it, and we don't allow it to be nishtakach min alev. And therefore it requires us, in order to maintain the joy and the simcha that will be the rebuilding of the Mikdash in the future, we have to keep the memory of the Mikdash alive to say to us that it's not a dead item, but it's still a live item. And that's what it means, kol amitavlim alea. Those that are mourning over Yerushalayim are the ones who are really keeping it alive. They're the ones who are really celebrating Yerushalayim and the rebuilding of Yerushalayim, the Mikdash, because they are showing through their Avelut that it's still a relevant issue. It's still a live topic. And it's not something that's dead, that nishtakach min alev. And therefore, those that are mitabel on Yerushalayim are the ones that sisuba. They're the ones who really believe in the future of Yerushalayim. It's a beautiful vort. I'm enhancing it a little bit, but the concept is that it's important by the Bayit HaSheni for us to have this avelut, or these items that are associated with it, because that shows our belief in the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash, that there will be a Beit Shlishi. So now Rabbi Yeshua offers the Prushim an alternative and says, Alakach amru chachamim. Here is a measured response to the avelut of the Mikdash. You can't be extreme in one case and do everything. You can't be extreme in the other case, which is to completely ignore it. Therefore, sadadam beito besid. The person is allowed to plaster his house with seed, umis sha'er bo davar muat, and he leaves over a space, zecher de churban. Vekama, how much does he have to leave over? Amrav Yosef, amal ama, it has to be one ama by one ama. Amrav Chista, keneged petach, it has to be opposite the door. You remember now, this I mentioned back on Daf Nun Gimel Amud Bet. Back on Nun Gimel Amud Bet, this is also a requirement with regards to how you're konen the Nechzei Ager. You have to do something of significance in the Nechzei Ager. And there, when it talked about doing something like Sid, it says you have to do the same qualifications, the same quote exactly, Amal Amak and Neged HaPetach. So what that Gemara in Nugimah Amud Bet tells you is, this is an action of significance. This is something that people will take notice of, and given that, you can acquire the Nixei Ager in that way. But similarly over here, it will also suffice for Zecher de Churban, because this is a significant enough action that people will take note of it when they enter into your house. If there's an Aman Amat, Keneged HaPetach, that will be something that strikes the person. They will notice when they come in, and then you'll accomplish the concept of Zecher de Churban. So over here, first of all, that is that it's important that it be Keneged HaPetach, that when people walk in, they see it. Though it is mentioned by the Mishnah Brura that there is a practice by some people, instead of putting the Amah V'Namah Keneged HaPetach, they put it over the doorway. And he tried to justify the practice by saying that the Baal HaBayit usually sits in his house, he sees that area is over the doorway, and therefore it would be striking or always be there in front of him. Although the proper practice, again, is to have it where it's possible to have it opposite the doorway, where it is noticeable and it should catch the eye of the individual. He also brings the Mishnah Brura from the fact that some people, instead of making that area white, they paint it black. And he says that is very problematic because painting that area black, in essence, is tziur. It's one of the other restrictions that we have before, which is not allowed to put these beautiful colored pictures on the wall. And so given that, you shouldn't be painting it. You shouldn't be adding in the black. He says that there is a practice that some do that painting of the black, but then they write on it Zecher de Churban, or they write on it Imeshkechei Yerushalayim. And he says in the Shaar Tzion there, even though that the Chaye Adam was machmir on that and thought it was problematic, says Mikol Makom Inirad Ein Limchot B'Yad HaMekilim, says that he doesn't want to be moche on those people that are mekil, because in essence you're accomplishing what the purpose of that square is, which is to remember Yerushalayim. And so the writing of Imeshkechei Yerushalayim, or putting something there that's indicative of that fact, should simulate or create the same effect, and therefore it might be appropriate. But again, painting it over or trying to disguise it or hide it is problematic. And the Torah does bring down that this leaving of an amah by an amah is a sufficient means to allow you to do all the things that we mentioned before. So he is mekil over here to say that all the three things that were restricted before, which was Mesayadin, Mechayirin, and Mefayachin, all of those are governed by this qualification in the Gemara of Amah Ba'amah. And therefore we are mekil, like the tour, that even if you do any of these items, as long as you leave a square of an Amah by an Amah, that would suffice in order to be in compliance with this law of doing things that are Zecher de Churban. And then the Mishnah Brura writes or bemoans the fact that he says, Bizmanenu lo nehagu l'shayir, that they don't leave over these Amah v'Amah. Yishar mishum to sumchim al yesh mekilim. Sounds like maybe that they are relying on the yesh mekilim that say that if it's mixed with something that we don't have the white seed that is there, and therefore they paint it over. It says, v'kol panim tamua shemrei melabnim abatim b'sid levad, that they do whitewash the houses or they do plaster the houses. They're not leaving over a space. And he says, maybe our seed is not the same seed as that they were speaking about. Says, Al kozeh dochak, b'tzara chiyun amash noagim heter. Says, I don't really understand why people are noag heter. And there is a demand that the individual make sure that they leave over that space of an amah ba'al amah. The Magen Avraham does have a qualification of the din that we saw before, which is if you buy the house with it already painted over, that you don't have to go then and undo it, or leave an amah ba'al amah. But he says, that's all, because we're toleh, that we assume, like the Bayit Tosfot said over here, we assume that it was bought from a non-Jew originally, or was built before the Bayit. Aval miyodeya, shenaseh biyisur, chayav bekofol. Magen Avraham says, if you know it was built inappropriately, it was built wrongly, without the amah v'amah limit, you have to go then and peel it off. You actually have to open up or undo that amah v'amah. So then, if you did buy a house from Israel, from Jews, that were only owned by Jews at some point, and they never left out an amah v'amah, and it was built inappropriately originally, then you would have a requirement then to peel off and to open up an amah v'amah so that you have something that is zecher de churban. In the Igud Moshe, he has a tshuva about someone who is renting a house. And over there he says that the renter has no obligation to leave out the amah al amah because it's not your ownership. You don't have sufficient ownership over there to dictate what happens. And therefore there's no requirement of leaving over an amah ban amah. And now the Gemara continues with the list of items that we do, Zecher de Churban, which is a Se'adam Kol Tzarchei Suda, Umishayir Bar Davar Muat. person, when they put together a feast, a meal, should have everything there, but they should leave something out. Mahi, what is that davar muat? Amrapapa kasa daharsana. Even a small dish, like the fish in the flour, some sort of fish hash that they had, that even that small side dish, if you leave it out, that is considered to be sufficient as zecher de churban habayit. Usei isha kol tachshita. A woman can adorn herself with all of her jewelry. Umishayeret davar muat. But she should leave out something small. Mahi, what is that? Amarav batzda'a. If you look in the Rashbam, he says batzda'a is a temple, which is the removal of the hair or the plastering to remove the hair by the temple. So she can wear all of these items, but she shouldn't do it to the fullest extent. Whether that's some sort of jewelry, a piece of jewelry that went by the temple, or it's the hair removal by the temple, either one of those is sufficient to be left out to consider that she's not wearing all of her jewelry. Shenemar, and they quote the pasuk, "Im eshkachek Yerushalayim tishkach yemini, tikdak lushani dechikim lo eskerechi." And you see from that that there's a requirement to do things that are zecher de churban. But this is the approach that Rabbi Yeshua is dictating, which is that you have to live life. You have to go on with life. You can't stop your lives with the korban habayit. But on the other hand, you can't be totally indifferent to the fact that the world is different now without a Beit HaMikdash. Therefore, we have certain practices that we undertake in order to remember the korban habayit. So one of those, again, is that you have to reduce that which you have in a su'uda. And that applies to all su'udot, even su'udot shel simcha, with the exception that Mishnah Berurah brings down of Shabbat and Yom Tov, because by Shabbat and Yom Tov, it's asur to have a velut, and therefore it would be inappropriate to give any sense or feeling of a velut, and therefore by su'udot Shabbat and Yom Tov, you shouldn't leave anything out, and it should be full-fledged simcha, or full-fledged everything that you would put in the su'udah. The Shulchan Aruch brings down that put together a su'udah, and you're having guests over. Mechaser mimenu ma'at. You should leave something small out of the su'udah. Umeniach makom panoi below kiara. You should leave an empty space without a setting that's there, or without the proper dish that should have gone there. And so what the Shulchan Aruch is pointing out is that you should leave over a space, but it should be obvious or clear from that which you are leaving over that you are doing something zecher de churban. If nobody knows, if there's nothing obvious that you're leaving out, then there's no zecher de churban. It has to be something that is, you are made, that the people are there aware of, so that they know that it is zecher de churban. As the Bishop Brewer notes, that's evil afilu besudat mitzvah kemila v'chatuna. This applies both to a brit milah, to a wedding, it applies to all of these items. Anytime you have something like this, you should leave something out, so that it is zecher de churban. It happens to be that in the last cycle, when we learned Baba Batra and we came on this daf fell out between the birth of my youngest child and his Brit Milah. And therefore, when we were putting together the Brit and we were going to have the Sudata Brit Milah, so there we made sure, I told my wife that we had to leave something out because of Zecher de Churban. So we did leave something out, but why was it be obvious? How would it be people know? So when I spoke at the Brit Milah, I noted that we have this Baruch Hashem, Simcha, and Sudat Brit Milah. But I want you to know that we decided to leave one thing off the menu, Zecher the Churban, so that people would be aware of the fact that we did something, we left something out, in order to be Zecher the Churban. Now, making it obvious or clear, the Mishnah Berurah brings down that the Levush left out this condition of leaving an area that is open or clearly designated for something and you don't put something down. Then he writes in the Sharet Zion, that's only in a case, that necessity for leaving an open space is only when you're leaving out something that people wouldn't have known otherwise. But if it is something that's normally served at the Su'udah, and you intentionally leave it out so it'll be obvious to people that something's missing, that in itself should be sufficient in order to be considered Zecher HaChurban, and then you don't need to leave out an open space, and that's what the Taz says, that you can put out all the dishes and everything the regular way as long as you're leaving something out that people would have expected. And leaving out what they're expected will generate the Zecher de Churban. Now, as far as the jewelry, the Mishnah Berurah brings one Heara, which is a nice idea just to mention, which is that a woman should not adorn herself with all the jewelry that she owns or everything that she has. She should leave out things. And he says, V'anashim amit kashtot b'milui. women who come fully adorned and wear all of their beautiful jewelry and everything, gormim levad zeh ra'ot rabot miumot olam yitzkanim bahem. Not only is it a problem of zeichel churban, but it's a separate problem of being showy, and that the non-Jews are jealous of the Jews who are dressing like this or adorned like this, and it causes problems not just because of the lack of zeichel churban, but it causes problems in that you are in some way an affront to your neighbors in the way that you present yourself. And so that wealth is not something that should be displayed or put in the front of others, because that only leads to bad results. And that there is a need for tzniut when a person has, or when a person has those abilities to display the wealth, it doesn't mean that they have to go and show it to everyone. It doesn't mean everybody has to know about it. Persons should be tzanua even in their wealth, and that's a good idea independent of this issue of zeichel churban. Dorot Chaim asked why the Gemara, when it was coming to lay out the things that we do zeichel churban, why did it pick these three items in terms of leaving the food out, not wearing all the jewelry that one wears, as well as leaving something out of the house when you build the house. He says that that's because these are the three basic items that everybody needs. He says, everybody needs these three things. Since you need those basic things, those are the things that Yaakov Avinu asked for as well. So therefore, we require in those three essentials of life, we require that you do some sort of zeichel churban in those areas. One is the house, which is classified as the mini Beit HaMikdash, the Kohen HaMikdash. Within the big day kehuna, which is the clothing of the individual, you should leave out something. And the food, which is like the korban itself, they require the zeichel churban. So those three essential elements that of one's life, as well as the three essential parts of the bayit itself, the kohanim or the big day kehuna, and the korbanot. So therefore, that's why the Chazal picked these three items in which to establish the zeichel churban. So now the Gemara continues and tries to understand. In the pasuk, it says, "Im yishkachei Yerushalayim tishkach imini, tikbal l'shonei dechiki, im lo yez kirechi, im lo yale Yerushalayim al rosh simchati." If I don't put Yerushalayim al rosh simchati, at the head of my simcha, that's what the Gemara asks over here. My al rosh simchati. What does it mean at the head of my simcha, at the primary simcha? Rav Yitzchak, ze ifer makleish b'rosh chatanim. That is the ashes that we put on the head of the chatan. So here, clearly, the Gemara is interpreting rosh simchati to be the wedding. The Torah Chaim suggests that, based on the Ma'amar Chazal, that a person who is married, shruya b'lisha, shruya b'lisimcha, one who's without a wife, without a woman, is living without simcha. And therefore, the beginning of the happiness of one's life is at the time of his marriage, at the time that he takes a wife. And that's what it means, rosh simchati. Rosh simchati doesn't mean the highest or greatest of my simachot, but the beginning of the simcha. And based on that, he also explains the minhag on the Leila Seder to put an egg on the kiara. And that also is zecher the churban that the Shulchan Aruch brings down. And he says it the same thing over there, that it's rosh simchati. Because we know that the essential aspect of the chagim and the moedot is the aspect of simcha and simchat yom tov. And therefore Pesach, which is the first of the cycle of the chagim, that is rosh simchati, the beginning of my simcha. In a similar way to the way explained by the chatan, that's the beginning of the simcha. So it's over here, the Pesach is the beginning of the chagim in which we celebrate the simcha. And therefore it's appropriate to have something zeichel churban at that time. And that's why we have the egg that is on the keara, to remind us of this idea that b'rosh simchati, there still is a necessity for zecher l'churban. Now, as far as the Efer Makleh, over here the Rashbam says that Efer Makleh that's mentioned over here is just in contrast to Efer Para. So it's coming to tell you, it's not the ashes of the Para Duma, which is another type of Efer that has halachic significance. So Efer Makleh is just in contradistinction to Efer Para. Then the Torah Chaim says that he thinks that Efer Makleh is a specific necessity to have ashes from something that's burnt in order to mikayim the zeichel churban. Because the zeichel churban has to remember the sreifat Beit HaMikdash, the churban abayit that happened through sreifa. And therefore, Efer Makleh is a requirement that you have a burnt wood or ashes of the wood, because those are the ashes that remind us of the churban abayit. The Balei Tosafot in the Gemara in Gittin, and then it's brought by others as well, suggests that the necessity for this is only for a chatan and a kala. Despite the fact that it should be for everyone, we should all be under this pall of the Churban HaBayit, the reason that we associate it specifically with the chatan and the kala is because there's a simcha yeterah. There's an extreme, a rosh simchati. There's an extreme form of simcha there. And the idea of putting the ashes on the head of the chatan, or the kala not wearing her Yerushalayim shel zahav, or certain atarot, Gemara says they goes there that the women shouldn't wear, is because those were the crown, those were the height of the beauty, the simcha of the chatan and the kala. So both the fact that it is their day of simcha, it's the height of simcha, as well as the fact that they wore crowns, so we replaced their crowns with a different kind of a crown. So the Zeg of the Churban takes on extra meaning in that context. First of all, it's a day of tremendous simcha, so therefore we have to temper the simcha. But the way that we temper the simcha is to replace what would have been the crowns that they wear with something that remembers the Churban HaBayit. Where do you put the ashes on the head of the chatan? B'makom tefillin, he says you put it in the place of the tefillin. Shenemar, because it says, Lashum levlei tzion, latet lehem pe'er tachat efer. It says about those of the mourners of Tzion, that Hashem will give them glory and a crown in the place of the efer, in the place where they had the ashes before. So there seems to be some connection or correlation between pe'er and efer. Efer is the ashes of mourning. Pe'er, based on the pasuk in Yechezkel, a pe'er chavush alecha, references to the tefillin. Glory will replace the ashes, but the Gemara is seeing the association of the glory of the tefillin will replace the ashes, and therefore the place of the ashes is in the same place where you put the pe'er. And pe'er references to tefillin, and that's the proper location for putting the ashes. The Rama over here notes that there was a minhag to also break a glass at the chatunah, and he says it's for the same reason as putting the ashes on the head of the chatan, which is to take down and reduce the level of simcha that is associated with the chatunah. Hisbura says that the same reason that they break something by the tanaim is again to remember or to have the zeichah d'churban associated with that. That's especially when the tanaim were separate from the chatunah, where they were not at the same time as the kiddushin and nisuin, and therefore at both events you would break something zeichah d'churban. And the Mishnah Berurah writes that none of this is considered to be bal tashchit, because it's not purposeless destruction. It's destruction for a purpose. It has a purpose in reducing the simcha or remembering Yerushalayim, and therefore it's not considered to be bal tashchit. And despite the fact that the Rama brings down this practice of breaking the cup, there's still many that practice putting the ashes on the head of the chatan or being makpid to do that, because that's a din of the Gemara, whereas what the Rama says is a minhag. And therefore, they want to maintain the minhag of the Gemara, which is to put the ashes on Zeichah d'Churban. The other thing to note about that is that today, because of the way that they break the glass at the chupa, everybody says Mazel Tov right after they break the glass. And in some ways, it's become inverse of what its purpose was. They break the glass and everybody says Mazel Tov. It's the opposite way around. The time of the breaking the glass is the time when there isn't Simcha. And so therefore, there might be, people have adjusted some of the Seder Kiddushin to break the glass in the middle, whereby then they can say Yishkachech Yishalayim Tishkach Yemini, and keep it more tempered around the breaking of the glass, so that it really turns out to be a Zeichah d'Churban, rather than the end of the chupa, where there becomes the beginning of the celebration, and therefore, in that way, they preserve the concept of the Zeichah d'Churban. V'chol amitabel al Yerushalayim zochev ro'eh b'simchata, and anybody who mourns over Yerushalayim will merit to see in its rebuilding and in its simcha. Shenemar, because they quote the pasuk from Yishayahu that we had spoken about before, which is Simchu et Yerushalayim v'gilubba kol avah, sisu ata masos kol mitablim aleha. Might be familiar to you because it's part of the Shiva d'Nechemta that we read after Tisha B'Av. And again, the explanation that we gave before, which is that only those people that are mourning are the ones that really believe that there will be a rebuilding of the Mikdash, and then therefore they will be zochet rebuilding the Mikdash. Because if you forget about it, that's an indication that you believe that it's a dead issue. And since it's a dead issue, then of course you're not going to be v'simcha on its rebuilding, and you won't be zocheh to see v'simcha. The person who joins in the tzara tzibur also will rejoice with the tzibur, and therefore one has to participate or be a participant in the zecher l'churban in order to merit the ability to see in the simcha the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash. So now we're going to finish off here the Gemara, Tanya Amar Rabbi Shmuel ben Elisha. Yom shecharab Beit HaMikdash, dinu shenigzor la'atzmenu, shelo le'echol basar, v'lo lishtot yayin. It should be that since the Churban HaBayit, we should have taken upon ourselves the gzeira of not eating meat, not drinking wine. But we don't put in or institute items that the majority of the people cannot uphold. And from the time that the evil empire has spread its arm on us, there's a reference definitely to the Romans, and most likely to the Hadrianic persecutions. They put on us these terrible evil decrees. And they are stopping us from practicing the Torah and the mitzvot. They don't allow us even to enter into the Shvua Ben. And others say it's the Yeshua Ben. Now, most interpret the Shvua Ben to referring to Brit Milah, the week of the Ben, which is after the 7th day, on the 8th day that you have a Brit Milah. Others suggest that the Shvua Ben is a meal that they had on the 7th day, the equivalent of what some people do today on the night before the Brit Milah. Then Vamrila Yeshua Ben, others say Yeshua Ben. Here you have a Machloket Rashi and Tosafot in other places. Some say Yeshua Ben is referencing to a Pidyon Ben. They don't allow us to practice Pidyon Ben. Or others say the Yeshua Ben is synonymous with a Brit Milah as well. And the Yeshua Ben, the Chatam Sofer, brings down an interpretation that Yeshua, the Gemara in Bamei Madlikin in Shabbat, says that Seder Nezikin is called Yeshua or Yeshuot. And therefore he says, because at the Brit Milah, we quote unquote do nezek to the child, that's why we don't say, according to some of the Ashkenazic practices, they don't say Shechiyanu at the Brit Milah. And that's why you don't say a Simcha b'me'ono when you bench at a Brit Milah, because of Tzar de Yanuka, because of the pain of the baby. And so given that reduction or that quote-unquote pain or tzar that comes out of the Brit Milah, so that's why it's known as Yeshua HaBen. So therefore, given these terrible persecutions, the Hadrianic persecutions, dinu shenigzar la'atzmenu, shelo lisa isha, ulehodad banim. We should put in a decree not to get married and not to have children. V'nimsa zaro shelam ravinu kala me'elav. And therefore, the Jews will be wiped out by themselves, or they will be self-terminating, which is the way that the Rashbam explains it, Binyan Tov. It's better if we go this way. That we shouldn't allow them to push us or press us into this situation. And therefore the mitzvot, they will not be abrogated because there'll be nobody to keep the mitzvot. So first of all, the Baal Tosafot have a question fundamentally on this idea, which is, don't you ever require Min HaTorah to do Pru or Vu? So the Baal Tosafot answer that yes, Eino Chanami, maybe the requirement or restriction would be that you could get married, do the mitzvah Pru or Vu, but after that you wouldn't have any more children. And in essence, that would be a self-terminating practice, because you'd only be replacing, a husband and wife would only have one boy and one girl, and they would only be replacing themselves, and therefore you'd have a diminishment in the population, and that's why the population would go down over time, because your birth rate would not necessarily exceed your existing population, and they would slowly diminish the population at hand. Others answer that the Chachamim have a right to institute things b'shev v'altase. When it's done in a passive manner, Chachamim have a right to do that. The examples they bring, obviously, are shofar and lulav on Shabbat. I would argue that maybe here it's a little different, because there the shev v'altase says, we don't blow shofar on Shabbat, we don't bring the lulav on Shabbat. But when Yom Tov doesn't fall out on Shabbat, and Yom Tov, you still have the mitzvah of shofar, you still have the mitzvah of lulav. Over here, if you created a shev v'altaseh and not to get married, you would eliminate the mitzvah of Pru Urvu completely. There'd be no accomplishment of the mitzvah of Pru Urvu. Maybe over there, we don't allow the Chachamim to institute something in a passive manner that abrogates the mitzvah completely and eliminates it completely. And that might be what compelled the Baal HaTosafot over here to say that you would accomplish the mitzvah of Pru Urvu, as well as the fact that the Gemara in Yevamot and other places notes that the mitzvah of Pru Urvu is a very special, unique mitzvah that has a very high standing in terms of its necessity to accomplish it. It doesn't have the rules of a regular mitzvah, so it would be hard to argue that the Chachamim would institute something that undermined Pru Revu, and that's why the Balei Tosfot are trying to accommodate Pru Revu within this Gzeirah. Ella, the Gemara says, Hanach Lehem LeYisrael, leave the Jews alone, Mutav Shiyu Shogegim, Value Mezidim. It's better that they are Shogeg, and they violate this Gzeirah B'Shogeg, and they shouldn't violate the Gzeirah B'Mezid. Which is the way that the Rashbam reads it. B'mesh, lukhim nashim. The fact that they're getting married, she'enam svurim she'eshi super davar, they don't think there's any problem in it. So the Gemara here is very difficult, because you see here that they never put the Gzeirah in place, because they understood that the majority of people would not be able to keep the Gzeirah, and therefore they never put the Gzeirah in place. Nevertheless, the Gemara seems to indicate that despite the fact that the Gzeirah wasn't put in place, it should have been put in place. And since it should have been put in place, we are governed in some sense by the necessity to keep this Gzeirah. And therefore the Gemara comments about it and says, Mutav Shiyu Shogegim. Better we don't tell people about the Gzeirah, and they don't know about it, and they violate it unintentionally, rather than the Yumi Zidin, that they should be intentionally violating Gzeirah, because they won't be able to keep the Gzeirah of not getting married. So you see that the lack of institution of the Gzeirah doesn't mean that there's not still an impact from the Gzeirah. It's not necessarily not appropriate to have this Gzeirah. And in a sense, we should be bound by it. Meaning there should have been a natural outcome from the Gzeirot is that we should have practiced this and we shouldn't have gotten married. And since we shouldn't have gotten married, we're now bound by this statement of Chazal, which is that Mutav Shiyu Shogegim Ba'yu Mezidim. And the Balei Tosafot over here qualify this principle and say that it's only true when we know for certain the people will not keep the din. Even if we have a safek, then we don't invoke this principle of Mutav Shiyu Shogegim Ba'yu Mezidim. It's also true that we apply it not only to Dinei Derabbanan, but even Dinei Doraita that are not Mefurash B'Torah. So but it has implications both in terms of giving tochachat to individuals, if they will listen or not listen, as well as establishing Gzeirot HaTakanot, which is that if there's any doubt or we have a suspicion that they will listen, then over there we encourage you either to give the tochacha or to put the gzeira in place. But if you know for certain they're not going to listen, that's where we invoke the principle of Mutav Shiyu Shogegim Ba'yu Mezidim. There is a beautiful explanation of this in the Chatam Sofer, who says that there is a promise to the Jews that the Jews will never be annihilated or wiped out completely. And so what the idea behind this gzeira was, is that we should throw the ball into God's court. Because if we keep reproducing and having children, then God doesn't have to intervene or do anything because the Jews still exist. And then we're going to be under these persecutions, we're going to be under difficult situations. So what we should do, in essence, is go on strike. We should stop reproducing, we should stop having children. If we stop having children, then Hashem will be compelled to intervene to stop the Gzeirah, because otherwise the nation will terminate or be wiped out, annihilated. And that's what he says was the idea behind Miriam coming to Amram in Mitzrayim, again, Minyona Diyoma, is that the Egyptians were persecuting the Jews, and therefore Amram felt that they shouldn't be having children anymore, because if they don't have the children, then Hashem will be compelled to intervene. And what the problem is, problem is that we have these rishayim that are not going to listen to the chachamim. Yazidu, v'isu nashim v'yolidu. They're going to get married and they're going to have children anyway. The kaven shidkaim zer Yisrael b'shum ofen ba'olam. Since there will be some remnant of Jews in the world, God will not be compelled to intervene. And it actually turned out to be an inverse accomplishment, which is all the tzaddikim will die out because they abide by the takanat chachamim. And on the other hand, the Rishayim, who ignore the Takanat Chachamim, they're going to be the ones who survive, or they'll be the continuation of Kalal Yisrael. And he says, that's exactly what Miriam says to Amram. Because you, Amram, you're a tzaddik, and you divorced your wife, you're not having children. Meantime, there are other Jews who are ignoring this Takanah, or this Gzeirah, the Chachamim of the door, and they're having children. So your ploy is not going to work. God's not going to be compelled to redeem us, because some Jews are having children still. But the Jews are having children and they're Rishayim. So you're better off that the Tzaddikim also have children, because this is not going to be a successful way to get God to intervene. And since it won't be successful, what you don't want to do is eliminate all the Tzaddikim and only leave the Rishayim around. And that is what it's meant over here by that they should have put the Gzeirah in place. Shalom Lisa Nashim. But they didn't do it because they realized it wouldn't be successful. And said, Mutav Shiyu Shogagim, I'll do Mezidim. They put it in place, then the Rishayim would be Mezidim in violating it. And so Mutav Shiyu Shogagim, even though it was Ra'oi to do it, we're not going to do it. And that's the way the Chatam Sofer speaks about it. Just as a side note here, that we're mentioning that it should have been put in place, and we didn't put it in place, is there any halachic nafkamina? There is a Mordechai in the Gemara in Yevamot that suggests that the Takana, or this Gezeret Chachamim, does have a halachic impact, and that is that we do not compel people to be Mikayim Puri or Rivya. The Gemara in certain places says that we compel individuals to do certain things. For instance, if they're married to a woman for 10 years, and they're unsuccessful at having children, we compel them to divorce, and then take another wife so that they're Mikayim Puri or Rivya. The Mordechai says that that requirement to be Kofe Al Puri or Rivya is suspended because of this Gemara. It's no longer relevant. Anytime the Gemara says that we compel somebody to do something because of the mitzvah of Puri or Rivya, that's no longer in place, or it's no longer relevant, because of this idea that's mentioned over here, that one should not get married anymore. Now, even though the Rova Poskim reject that view of the Mordechai, it's interesting that the Mordechai took this idea that there should have been a Gzeirah so seriously to the point that he thought it had a halachic impact. And with that, we complete Cheskat HaBatim, Hadron Halach, Cheskat HaBatim.